Yes, there is certainly there is increased interest in potassium. We know, well, potassium has always been an issue on cotton production. There is no question that the price of fertilizer this season resulted in at least a 30% increase on the number of soil samples in our state. We ran around 120,000 samples, most of them grease samples, and a lot has to do with the price of fertilizer. Fortunately, the price of urea has come down, but price is an issue, and that's why there is a more attention paid to potassium and phosphorus. This year in particular, we had problems with alternaria and cercospora, and we know they can be associated with low potassium levels. You know, cell walls weaken. We have deficient conditions, and that opens the door for pathogens. And but at the same time, we know that if it is too wet or too dry, regardless of how much potassium there is, I mean, we may have this problem. So and the other issue too, again, on potassium, related to this particular talk, it had to do also with uptake trend of potassium by cotton. And for the last 10 years, we've been hearing that modern cultivars tend to, the uptake trend is different. And we know by the time the cotton plant cut out, probably using still 4 to 5 pounds per acre of potassium. In reality, a cotton plant it's not easy for a plant to compensate for a potassium deficiency, because of the trend. I think a cotton plant can compensate a lot easier for nitrogen, but not for potassium. And a lot has to do also with the fact that that the root activity goes down in some varieties after first bloom. So, and by the time we see these symptoms of potassium deficiency, we know that, the ball is a stronger sink. So if you see potassium deficiency in the leaf, it probably has affected the balls already. So what are the objective of this presentation is really present a summary of several potassium-related studies, okay? And again, everything has to do. We are trying to do the rate studies, we do rate studies, but I'm not going to show any of that here. Something we've been doing is trying to stress the point that foliar fertilization doesn't replace soil applied fertilizer, and it's particularly when the price of fertilizer is high. We have, believe it or not, quite a few farmers who've been doing a lot more foliar feed when it's not supposed to be used. Foliar fertilization is just a supplement to a good soil applied program. And like in this case, you see, this is 4554. We've done this with triple nickel, 444, and it's basically the same result. You see, this actually should be 90 pounds per acre compared to the Czech. This Melic 3 level is 220, 250 pounds per acre. We apply two applications of 5 pounds per acre of potassium, a first bloom, like the same at first square. These are two different treatments. And somebody may say, well, you see, in reality, the work Derek Kusterhaus did, he recommended 16 pounds per acre. But in reality, foliar fertilization should not replace soil applied fertilizer. So we've been doing some of this to make sure that, more like another educational, for educational purposes. We have been also looking at, if there are differences in the way varieties use a potassium fertilizer. In this case, you see, we look at 444 and 5599, similar trends by first square and first bloom. This, the y-axis is actually pounds per acre. And What we did here is we took, I think it was 5 or 10 plants per, no, it was like 40 plants, and we tried to, you know, partition the accumulation. And interestingly, you see by first bloom, basically no difference, but by peak bloom, it looks like 5599 certainly had accumulated a lot more potassium than 444. And it kind of makes sense, you know, it tends to have a different architecture, a root activity in 5599 or triple nickel or that type of varieties tends to be higher than 444. And this by no means shows that we need to fertilize 5599 with more potassium than 444. We need to remember that the efficiency of potassium use is not 100%, okay? So this just shows, because in this particular case, there were no significant differences in yields, but there appeared to be difference in accumulation, but again, it doesn't mean that, you know, we need to fertilize them differently, at least as far as we know. So we've been trying to understand how it is partitioned. The other thing I was trying to do too is understand how the yield is partitioned on a plant that is deficient compared to a plant that is sufficient in potassium. And again, this should be 90 pounds per acre. This is fruiting node. This is cumulative weight, but I guess the numbers are not, may not be as important as the relative distribution. You see, obviously, if there's plenty of potassium, there are more fruiting nodes. There are probably, what it was interesting, again, in this case, is that the trend seemed to be the same. I thought that if it was deficient, maybe there will be less third positions and probably more first position, and that happens. I've seen that a lot, but in this study, that's the type of trend we saw, and this is, I think this is triple nickel. We did this in 5599 and 444 as well. So again, what I'm trying to do is we're trying to understand how it is partitioned. So if we understand that, maybe we can learn how to manage the fertility. We just finished, that's one part of, that's one type of study we're doing. The other this is another study. We just finished a 3-year study funded by Cotton Incorporated. This actually was a field scale study. You know, farmers sometimes complain the small plots don't work, that they want to look at real scenarios. Well, I had my concerns about this, but this is, we had 3 locations during 3 years. Our plot size was 24 rows by 400 feet long, replicated 4 times. We collected the yields with a yield monitor, and we will average the yields of the whole plot. And this is more or less, the study. Again, in reality, the treatments went all the way to the middle of the pivot. You notice that we tried to find areas that were uniform. That's a map, the S-Sorgo map, and according to that, it seems uniform. Well, guess what? At the end of the 3 year, okay, these are the treatments because there was interest in validating our recommendations. So the treatments were our extension recommendations, and our extension recommendations plus 30, 60, 90, plus 90 pounds, okay, pre-plant, and there was another treatment of 60 pounds potassium at first bloom. You know, that's really, will have complicated actually statistics because it was a timing and a rate study anyways, but I treat it like it was just one thing, you know. Anyways, but at the end of the 3-year study, no significant differences, okay. When you compare our extension recommendations against all those increments. Well, you see, but again, I had my issues because I know there is a good reason why we do small plots, okay? And this afternoon, Terry Griffin will be talking some about, doing the difference between doing small plots and large plots. This is just an example of the yield variability within a plot. And this was common, you see. You see, when we look at the variability in yield, it is significant. So we will normally average, average the yields there. And there was certainly, there were some problems there. I mean, I was concerned that that variability might have masked the potential results. So the only thing we could do was, run electrical conductivity, very easy. So what we did with the help of Terry Griffin then is we use EC as a covariant, and we use spatial statistics. So what we did is we defined I'm just a practitioner in that area, define areas of influence around that electrical conductivity readings. And when we plotted, electrical conductivity against cotton yield, it looks like, there were some significant differences. In other words, if you look, this is the 90 pounds per acre, this is a significant yield difference. Okay, so there was a yield response based on electrical conductivity, but this is something, in reality, the only thing that this does is explain the variability, okay? I don't know that we can say, okay, that we can use electrical conductivity now to do variable rate. And I think that's where we still need to do a lot of work. The only thing this does is explains the variability in that particular location, but I think it was interesting, okay? And what it was interesting too is that, our recommendations or any recommendations tend to work on the average conditions. When we talk about a representative soil sample, we talk about we apply fertilizer based on that representative soil sample, we know, or we should know, that we are applying more fertilizer than needed in some areas and less fertilizer than needed in other areas because it's a representative soil sample, okay? And that's what we use in this study, and that's what I still use, and that's why variable rate is probably right now, it is appealing because, again, probably one representative soil sample is not enough anymore. Okay, but this was interesting. This is something hopefully we will continue doing and try to develop some relationships. The other thing I'm interested is, look at the different forms of potassium in the soil. Okay, we know that potassium can be found as a structural component, as a non-exchangeable, as exchangeable, and in solution. Salt test, in reality, salt test for potassium is not really, I don't know, we put too much predictive value, I think, on our salt test. Or in other words, there is still a lot of work we need to do in that arena. That's why I'm concerned about people doing variable rate too, because we still have a lot to do on salt testing, We know that some of these non-exchangeable can become exchangeable, okay? And that's not accounted on salt tests, okay? This is typical. This can be typical in Arkansas and many other places. In the same field, we can have different textures. Or we can have fields, Kelly fields and sandy fields on alluvial soils, because they are alluvial, there are a mix of everything. some properties, selected properties in that scenario. You see, when you look at the textures, look at the malic tree, and this is part of my graduate student work. We were looking at different texture that tested the same malic tree, okay? And this is the best we could do, actually. This non-exchangeable potassium is done by, it's called tetraphenyl boron, and you see, this is more or less, when I look at malic tree and non-exchangeable, malic tree is more or less like your checking account, and non-exchangeable is more like your savings account, okay? So what this is telling you, Okay, this, the savings account on this end alone is really low. It's just like my checking account, I guess. And on the clay soil, you see it's more or less not much difference, but it, the checking account is really thick, hard, just like Dr. Ebelhardt's, you know. Anyways, so what we are trying to do, but the thing there is that those you see, even though those samples vary on the non-exchangeable, and they are similar on the soil test, and there is a good chance that they will receive the same recommendation for potassium. Okay, and so what we did, we've been working with something called quantitative intensity ratio, which is more or less the relationship between, and this is my definition 5 minutes ago, readily available potassium and potassium that can become plant available. Okay, so we are looking at what is called the buffer capacity. And we selected 23 different soils, and wanted to look at the contribution of that exchangeable and non-exchangeable, okay? Again, it's not the classification of clay or silty clay or sandy loam, it's really gross, okay? Because you can have a silty clay soil with completely different clay composition, okay? And that, it is significant when it comes with the dynamics of potassium. So we, in addition to that, we are also trying to do X-ray, we are looking at the mineralogy, looking at the type of clay and see if that type of clay has an effect on releasing potassium that can become plant available. And we are still working on that. Well, in summary, okay, we've done this test, and I know these units might not mean much right now, but I guess the point here is that sandy, that a silty clay loam can have between, 5 to 10 times more buffer capacity than a sandy loam or a silt loam that we analyze. And that has very significant implications. It can mean that at a clay soil, of course, you know, we need to apply a lot more potassium to increase the soil test. But it also could mean that a clay soil can release potassium, you know, for it can become plant available at a larger extent than a silt loam. In other words, there is a chance that a given soil, that soil threshold levels are different from different types of soils. So that's what we are trying to do, you know, get to a point where we can actually derive that type of information. Now, going back to, but in addition to that, to analyze the total buffer capacity, we wanted to know what the influence of the exchangeable portion and the non-exchangeable portion on the buffer capacity. Because if the buffer capacity of a soil is all related to the non-exchangeable portion, there is really any easy way to quantify it. Because remember that the soil test doesn't look at soil non-exchangeable. But if most of it is related to the exchangeable portion, maybe we can use cation exchange capacity as a surrogate to you know, maybe eventually fertilize or understand more. And it happens that on the clay soils, at least the ones we had at Charkey clay, 80% of that was of the buffer capacity was actually related to the exchangeable portion, and 20% to the non-exchangeable. Actually, some of the silt loams, it was mixed. Some of them, a high percentage related to an exchangeable, another silt loams related to non-exchangeable, and that has to do related to the, to the clay mineralogy, to the actually clays that that are part of that. And again, that's why I said when we said silt loam, that's really a gross, it's a gross classification. We really need to understand more about that. So basically, that's what I have in that. And yes, stay tuned because we will continue doing more of this work, okay? I don't know if you have any questions, but I'll be glad to. To answer any. Yes, sir.
How many years have you done this study?
Oh, no, this is just, oh, no, because we take salt sample. I mean, you mean this, the buffer capacity? No, all of this is lab studies, you know. We have greenhouse work, you know, and it is basically impossible to do this type of work in under field conditions, you know. I mean, of course, eventually you would like to bring this knowledge into the fields, but we first need to understand what's going on in terms of chemistry.
If you have any more questions for Dr. Espinoza, let's wait to the last two speakers.
Thank you.
Thank you, Leo. Our next